Okay, let's go ahead and get started. This is time set for the public hearing on ADKT 0598, requesting the Supreme Court to adopt rules of conduct for lawyers representing children in welfare cases. First of all, welcome. And as you'll notice, you've got Justice Stiglitz and I here in Carson City. Let's see, you've got Justice Pickering. I see Justice Pickering in Las Vegas. And Chris, are you down? Is anybody else down there with you?
There are a number of people in the audience, but no one on the bench with me.
Okay.
And I do have Lily handling the IT.
All right, very good. And you will see Justice Hardesty also participating remotely. Justices Herndon and Kadish and Silver will be listening to the tapes after the fact. They will be deliberating with us when we make a determination on this particular ADKT. So with that being said and done, let's go ahead and introduce this matter. And I believe this was introduced by Justice Hardesty. And Justice Hardesty, would you like to make a few comments related to the petition?
Yes, Chief. Thank you very much for entering the order setting the public hearing on this petition. Going back at least 2 or 3 years ago, I have had frequent meetings and conversations with various individuals regarding this topic, and beginning last spring, while I was still Chief Justice, lawyers within the Children's Project of the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada had been working in earnest with the preparation of rules of professional conduct governing the representation of children in child welfare cases, particularly as the petition demonstrates in connection with the approaches taken by the American Bar Association. I want to thank and applaud Amy Honadell, the entire team over there for all the hard work that they have undertaken. As the petition indicates, they have prepared a draft, which is the Exhibit A to the petition. They have circulated the drafts with other legal aid organizations within the state, which I am informed and believe and represent, and based on some letters we've received, supports the requested relief, which is to adopt the rules. Similarly, they have consulted with Justice Kadish, who serves as co-chair of the Children's Commission, who I am informed as well supports this effort. And I am also informed that they presented these drafts to the Board of Governors, as well as to the two ABA delegates in consultation with the preparation of the draft rules. And they too, they also, I should say, support the petition and its request. I'd like to, I can't see the audience in Las Vegas, so I'll depend on my colleague, Justice Pickering, but I believe that there are representatives from the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, and they are the principal authors and proponents of the rules. And I'd like to thank and commend them for bringing them to me and for allowing me to bring them to the attention of the court. With your permission, Chief, I'd like to call on their designated representative to offer any additional remarks or an overview of the rules and answer any questions that the justices may have. And then at that point, perhaps with your permission, would be appropriate to open the hearing for additional comment from others in the who are present in the community.
Okay, very good. Yes, in Las Vegas, I can't see. My screen is really tiny, so I can't see who's down.
Yes, maybe that's good. Good afternoon. I am Janice Wolf, and I am the directing attorney of the Children's Attorneys Project at Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, and I'm also a certified child welfare law specialist. And also with me here at council table is Amy Honadell, and I know you're very familiar with her. She is also a certified child welfare law specialist and one of the drafters of our petition that's in front of the court. I would like to begin with just in my role of giving the court some history and context in what led up to our being here today. 23 years ago, the Clark County manager telephoned our Legal Aid Center Southern Nevada office and asked if we would be willing to represent children in child welfare cases. At that time, Nevada was one of only a handful of states in the entire nation that did not provide independent representation to children in foster care. The county at that time was willing to devote funding to launching the project and felt strongly that children in child welfare should have an independent voice in the dependency process. And they also felt that the dependency court judges should have the benefit of hearing all voices, all perspectives, before rendering decisions that affect families for a lifetime. The county was concerned and felt that the children's voices were not being heard. Of course, knowing Barbara Buckley, she said yes, and the Children's Attorneys Project in Clark County was born. We started with the task force. We researched best practices throughout the country, and the American Bar Association at that time actually assigned a national expert to us as we designed our project. The first recommendation that the ABA made to us was that we had our attorneys follow an attorney-client traditional relationship and not follow a guardian ad litem program. They told us that our lawyers should not substitute their own personal opinions for representing child clients. They gave us guidance on how to represent infants and toddlers and children with disabilities, reminding us that they had statutory, legal, and constitutional rights that were needed independent legal protection. They also reminded us that we had a guardian ad litem / best interest model already, our CASA program, and that what we needed were strong, independent children's lawyers that could file motions and appeals and challenge the Parents Council and the Child Welfare Council when appropriate. This made sense to our project, and we hired our first attorney, who is an experienced trial attorney defending children in New York City for decades. So we took our first CAP case in 1999. Today, our program grew slowly, and we tried to do it in a very methodical way. In 2005, I became CAP attorney number 5 at the Legal Aid Center. Today, we represent some 3,700 children at a time in Clark County, over 6,000 children a year through 29 staff attorneys and 350 pro bono lawyers. And we have 4 staff attorneys who are certified national child welfare law experts on our program. Along with the way, we learned a lot. We learned about siblings were being separated and foster care, and we began filing motions to keep them together.
we learned about itty bitty kids who were being so over-medicated with psychotropic drugs that they could not stay awake. So we began filing motions to get their care reevaluated. And we learned of young children who were in psychiatric hospitals for months without due process. Thanks to our advocacy, that is no longer the case. We are extremely proud of what we have accomplished on behalf of children and on behalf of the child welfare system in general. We are also extremely proud that Washoe County and the state and other state offices in general adopted programs that were very similar to ours. And in 2019, with the support of Clark County, we sponsored legislation that confirmed that children of all ages are parties to dependency proceedings and are entitled to legal representation. We ensured that money was provided to make that happen. The same year, the National Association of Counsel for Children named our Children's Attorneys Project the best children's law office in the nation based upon our model of representation and our accomplishments. The rules proposed in ADKT 0598 are set forth in the Model Act governing the representation of children in child welfare cases that the ABA adopted as best practices in 2011. We are simply asking that the ABA model become the standard of representing children in Nevada. We thank you for your support of our program and hope that attorneys representing parents and attorneys representing child welfare agencies will follow our lead and consider standardizing their own rules of professional responsibility as they apply to their unique disciplines. For today, we simply urge you to adopt ADKT 0598. Thank you very much, and I would like to introduce Amy Honeville.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Thank you, Chief Justice Perigary, Justice Stiglitz, Justice Hardesty for bringing this issue, and Justice Pickering for giving us your most valuable time on an issue that means a lot to me. My name is Amy Honeville. I am the Strategic Initiatives Manager for the Children's Attorneys Project at Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, which I know is a mouthful, so I hope that's as complex as I get today. But I represent right now, 97 children from a few months old to a young lady who's going to turn 21 on Thursday. And because I believe in the rights and the plights of those children, my clients, I think it's very important that we take a look at this issue today. And that is the rules, the proposed rules of conduct for lawyers governing children. And I just want to state at the outset that as one of the co-drafters or co-developers of these rules, that they're not meant to replace any statute or procedure or any decision rendered by this court on the rights of kids in foster care. Instead, we are looking at the Nevada Rules of Professional Conduct, which govern relationships between attorneys and all clients, and building upon that to provide strong, competent legal representation to children in foster care who are vulnerable and seeing some of the worst times of their lives. So, and in fact, if you look at the proposed rules of conduct, I believe we've incorporated Nevada Rule of Professional Conduct 1.14 on diminished capacity outright, but you'll see recurring themes of Model Rule 1.1 on competence, 1.2 on the scope of representation, and 1.3, which talks about diligence and zealous advocacy throughout these rules. And so that is the framework that we are coming from. These are to be used and considered as a supplement to our existing Nevada Rules of Professional Conduct on how lawyers who represent kids are going to meet their duties in a diligent, competent manner so that law and the rights of these kids are protected going forward in these cases. So they're based upon, and I believe Janice mentioned, the 2011 ABA Model Act governing lawyers representing kids in abuse, neglect, and dependency proceedings. To the extent that things are not in from the 2011 Model Act, it is because we've already addressed those in our 20-something years representing kids here in Clark County, and then with the addition of Washoe and the rurals, we've addressed through court rules and in statute certain things. So this is really about the duties that lawyers owe to kids. And I want to just go ahead and address the opposition or the concern that was presented by the Office of the District's Attorneys, and that has to do with substituted judgment and our representation of kids who are pre-verbal, non-verbal, or in some way of diminished capacity. So going back to what I said about Rule 1.14, the Nevada Rules of Professional Conduct already have guidance for lawyers faced with that. And in fact, we see that in other areas of law. We see that in criminal defense. We see it in issues of elder law, civil commitment. And in fact, the rules for guardianship addressed how lawyers were going to represent protected persons. And in all of those areas, and what we want to do and what we want to follow with the 2011 ABA Model Act, is maintain the integrity of the adversarial role. The courts work because we have parties and they're represented by attorneys who are trained in those areas and are able to present their clients' wishes and then advocate for decisions in line with their clients' legal interests. This model, at least as to children, I think it's been around longer for criminal defense and elder law, but for children has been around, we've been using it for 22 years. The American Bar Association didn't call it substituted judgment, but they had it in their standards of practice in 1996. And what all of those bodies of authority say is that kids, regardless of age and regardless of capacity, have certain due process and fundamental legal rights, both from the United States Constitution and in the federal mandates for the preserving the integrity of the family. And so the way to best protect that is to give them lawyers, traditionally trained lawyers who owe the same duties of diligence, competence, zealous advocacy, and confidentiality. And there's been a question about what happens with kids who cannot direct, they cannot express their interest to their attorney into how they want to have their case handled. The American Bar Association uses the term substituted judgment, but I believe it's a rather inartful term. And in trying to develop these rules or proposed rules, we hesitated with it, but because it's from the American Bar Association, we decided to keep it. But really, it's not substituting our judgment. It is taking a legal analysis. We look at the circumstances of the case. We look at everything objectively. We learn about the child, the child's needs, the child's development, the child's family, the child's culture, the child's ethnicity, and look at the individual circumstances, and then take that in context of their legal rights. And from that, we make a determination about what that client's position is. And that's a lot. So I teach the introductory CLE for our 350 pro bono volunteers, and that gets a little overwhelming to them. But I walk them through it, and I say another way to look at it is pretend that baby is a sassy 14-year-old client wanting to know why you did X. Not why I chose X for me, but why I chose X for them. And that's why it's not our judgment. It's not our decision about best interest. We're not social workers. We're lawyers. We're trained to identify legal rights, both current and future, because we're talking about the future of these children as well. They're going to wind up in somebody's home, hopefully forever. So it's not just about that, but it's about the family integrity and then making a decision in line with that. So that's how I train the pro bono attorneys. But if we were to say, okay, let's do best interest for the little kids, the kids who can't articulate something, it just presents a slew of problems. The first, it will turn our statutory scheme for attorneys and guardians ad litems on its head. So NRS 432B.420 requires all kids or parties on all kids get lawyers, and there's no limit as to age. And within that statute, it says that attorneys for the kids have the same authority and rights as an attorney representing any other party. So that means the same duty of zealous advocacy, diligence, competence as the parents' attorneys, as the child welfare agency's attorneys. Then we have 432B.500, which is our guardian ad litem statute. And within that, it says, number one, that the GAL, the guardian ad litem, cannot be the attorney for the child. But it also gives a very specific list of duties, including best interest, determining what they are, and telling the court what those best interests, what they believe the independent, their independent judgment on what the best interest should be. And if we were to adopt a best interest model for attorneys, then we're not going to be doing the same things, exercising the same authority as the attorneys for the other parties, but essentially we become an arm of the court. We become a friend of the court, and we will be echoing the GAL program, which is a wonderful program and staffed by our CASA volunteers, and they play an important role. So it would essentially render our jobs as attorneys nugatory. It also would create a bunch of other problems, including how to determine when a child becomes able to direct representation. I've had 12-year-olds who couldn't tell me what they want, and I've had very sassy 3-year-old toddlers tell me exactly what they want without an understanding of adoption or TPR, termination of parental rights. They can tell me very much how much they love their mother or are scared of their mother. It also would create difficulty when we have sibling groups. The bulk of my clients are part of a sibling set of 2 up to 6, and I have some that can't talk in one sibling group and some that can, and it'll present, you'll have 2 different models of representation within one case, and it would just create chaos. So there's some authority out there from a national expert, Don Duquette, who's worked at the QIC program for lawyers representing kids out of the University of Michigan. And one of the things he says is that one of the clearest ways to get effective representation for kids is to tell the lawyers exactly what they need to do. When they don't know what they need to do, that's when the confusion abounds. And that's what ADKT-0598 will do. It will tell lawyers who represent kids exactly what they need to do to represent these kids zealously, diligently, confidently, and all in line with the rules of ethics. And for that, I'm asking that this court adopt the rules without any changes. Thank you.
Okay, colleagues, any questions? All right, is there anyone else there in Las Vegas speaking as a proponent of this measure?
Yes, Chief. Good afternoon. My name is Dawn Hathaway Toman, and I've been a CAP attorney since I graduated law school 7 years ago. I only do pro bono CAP work. It's the only job that I have. I'm very fortunate to be able to do that. I just wanted to share a very short anecdotal story with you that I think illustrates why all children, including those who are pre-verbal, non-verbal, those who lack capacity, why they all need an independent CAP attorney, not just people who advocate for the best interest. So one of my very early cases was a young man who, when I entered the case, everyone was advocating for what they thought was best for him. And everyone thought he should be reunified with his natural mother. And after some time, when I got to know him, we built some rapport and trust, he explained to me that he didn't want to go back to mom. And it was tough for him to be able to express that. And he said that he was tired of mom doing drugs in front of him, and he didn't want to live on the streets anymore, and he had had a really tough life. He loved his foster mom, and his deepest desire was to be adopted by foster mom. So to make a very long case short, in the end, we were successful, and he was able to be adopted by foster mom. And we arranged, of course, some visits with natural mom so she could still be part of his life. But the little boy was so overjoyed that when we left court that day, he was digging through his pockets because he insisted that he wanted to pay me for doing such a good job. So he found a penny in his pocket. It was all the money that he had to his name, and he gave that penny to me. And it remains the only money I've made so far as a licensed attorney, a fact of which I'm pretty proud, actually. I prefer to be paid in blessings. But I just want to say that I'm here in full support of the proposed rules as written, and in particular, the substitute judgment cost. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Mona Kovett, and I'm a partner at the law firm of Kemp Jones. I practice primarily in the areas of complex civil and commercial litigation, but I'm very passionate about the Children's Attorneys Project, or CAP, at the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, and I've represented dozens of nonverbal and verbal foster children for nearly a decade as a pro bono CAP attorney. I externed with CAP almost 15 years ago as a law student, and to see how much the program has evolved and that it's been nationally recognized makes me so proud. Barbara Buckley and her amazing team at Legal Aid have fought so hard to ensure that every foster child in our state has a right to independent legal counsel during the most difficult time of their life. This right should never be taken away from them and should be protected by codifying rules of professional conduct. As a pro bono CAP attorney, I fully support the proposed rules of conduct as written. Legal Aid has trained us on similar rules when representing child clients, which have been followed for many years, but having defined and concrete rules all in one place would be extremely beneficial to our legal community and our child clients. I understand that there has been some opposition to the terms substituted judgment when representing nonverbal clients and that best interests should be used instead. I also understand that there has been some argument that a guardian ad litem should, quote, direct the representation of these clients rather than a CAP attorney. I respectfully disagree. The role of a CAP attorney is extremely important and cannot be replaced. And this role is just as important to a nonverbal client. When I've represented nonverbal clients pro bono, I'm involved throughout the entire process. From the moment that child is born, from the moment that child's abandoned at the hospital, throughout trial, adoption, and I'm even currently working on my first appeal. I file briefs on behalf of my clients. I advocate for their legal rights in court. I participate and question witnesses at trial in order to get the complete picture of what my nonverbal client would want. Again, this role cannot be replaced. I've always followed the guidelines provided by Legal Aid and put myself in the shoes of my nonverbal clients when representing them. There are multiple factors to consider when determining what a nonverbal client would want, separate and apart from my own independent judgment. The analysis may be different, but the ultimate want is the same, to be in a safe and loving home. Ultimately, as written, the rules of conduct provide additional guidance on how to represent a child client, which will help attorneys better understand and feel more comfortable with the process and hopefully encourage others in our community to volunteer as a pro bono CAP attorney as well. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Justice. I'm Judge Frank Sullivan from the 8th Judicial District Court, and I've had the honor and privilege to preside over child welfare cases for near 23 years, I guess, is what it comes down to. I remember when Counsel Wolf said, I remember the first CAP, unfortunately, that's how old I am on that. So I've watched it grow from our children not having representation, the children having representation, to parents not having representation, to parents having representation, to the district attorney being an agency model, represent Department of Family Services, and our CASA program growing. I think as of Friday, we have 393 CASAs. I've seen that grow from, I think, 8 when I started out there. So we've seen a tremendous growth of the child welfare system. I have reviewed the ABA model at governing the representation of children, abuse and neglect. I do support ADKT 0598. I think it's important to have rules of conduct for lawyers on that. I do note that the client-directed model, Legal Aid has always followed that client-directed model as long as they appeared in front of me, and that makes sense because the child's the most important. That's why we're here. It's about the voice of that child and the child's wishes being heard loud and clear by the court. Court doesn't always go along with the child's wishes because the court has the ultimate determination to determine what's best interest of the child, but the more feedback we get from the different parties, I think it makes it easier for the court to make a more informed decision. I think there's a lot of confusion as to best interest and substituted judgment. If you read the ADKT 0598 in conjunction with the ABA Model Act governing the representation of children and abuse, they talk about client-directed model. They also, the commentaries, even talks about from the American Bar Association that basically you have a difference between the best interest and the substituted judgment. Substituted judgment is basically a good faith effort by the attorney to determine what the child would wish if the child was able to make an adequately considered and informed decision. It's not them deciding what they think that child should want, which is what we do many times with best interest. We decide what we think is best for the child. It's for them to determine what their child wishes would be and then representing that child in accordance with that determination. Best interest, for example, when I used to have some of the older children, I'd have 18-year-olds come, and they decide they don't want to be in the system anymore. They've had a bad experience. The system was horrible to them from their perspective. They wanted out. And I had a CASA, court-appointed special advocate, said they don't think it's best interest for that child to exit the system. And they were probably right many times because the study showed that 60% of the youth that age out of the system are homeless within 2 years or have experienced homelessness, and 40 to 50% of the males that exit out of the system have been subject to an arrest within the first 2 years. So many times it's not in the best interest that child's not ready to go off on his own, but that's the child's wishes on that. So I would grant that the child would no longer stay in the system after turning 18, even though it may not be in that child's best interest. So there's a different role that they play with the best interest and this child's voice on that. And the important thing is the how they come to the substituted judgment. It's based on objective facts, interview of the child, observing the child in the environment, talking to other parties that have a relationship with that child, caregivers of that child, experts of that child, DFS representatives, and determining what they think that child would want. Not what the adults think that child should want, not what the court thinks what that child should want, but what they think that child's wishes would be, and argue that for the court so the court can make the decision as the court's obligated to do. So I think it's very important. It is child-centered, number one. It is research-informed. They need to do their homework so they can convince the court that they made a good faith effort to determine the child's wishes. Permanency-driven, to make sure we're getting these children permanency, holistic approach, and basically addressing the child's legal rights, which attorneys are obligated to do, including sibling relationships, relatives, expeditious resolution of the case for the child on that, and basically the least restrictive alternative to make sure all these child's safety, well-being, and permanency. For those reasons, I think that the model, the rules of conduct submitted here, ADKD 0598, is the same as the American Bar Association's best practices, even with the comments right from Section 7D of the ABA as to the conduct, duties of a child's lawyer and scope of representation. It's identical to that, and I think that's the best practices. Therefore, I fully support the passage of the 0598. Thank you for your time, Justices.
Thank you, Judge.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Perigree. I'm Dan Pulsenberg, and I've represented Nevada in the ABA House of Delegates for the past 14 years. In fact, I voted for the Model Act that we're discussing here, and I remember the presentation that the litigation section put on. And representatives from that group would get up there and say, you know, this doesn't act like a court. This doesn't act, we're not acting like lawyers. We shouldn't be assigned to figure out what the result should be for our clients. We should be listening to our clients and advocating their position. That's how the adversary system works. That's how due process works. And I've explained that a little more detail in the amicus brief in SB that I filed for the National Association of Counsel for Children. But that's what the system should be. We should be being lawyers and advocating the position of the client. There are enough people in the system that will decide, as Judge Sullivan said, decide matters based on what they think the best interest is. The child needs to be represented. Now, I will agree with everybody that the term substituted judgment was a bad idea. It sounds bad. You know, district court doesn't substitute its judgment for an administrative agency. This court on appeal doesn't substitute its judgment for matters of evidence or discretionary findings of the district court. But that's not what this is. This isn't substituted judgment. When I'm a lawyer in a CAP case, I don't decide what's best for the child. I try to figure out what the child wants. Amy talked about how to do this. Judge Sullivan talked about how to do this. It's an extrapolated judgment. It's an extrapolated analysis. We could change that term in this rule if we wanted to. And frankly, in 2011, I didn't think about the term enough for it to give me concern. But when I see the opposition by the district attorneys, that I realize that's what we need to do is make clear. First, they say that SB, although it's an unpublished decision, said that that this rule would create a conflict between 4B2 and the statutes. No, it would. I don't think the court said that in SB. I think what the court said is that there isn't a provision of authority for the for the lawyers to do the things that were involved. This petition creates rules that make clear that that authority is there. And is there a clash between the guardian ad litem and the attorney? Well, yeah, there is, because we serve different functions. I'm representing the client, the child. The guardian ad litem or the CASA volunteer is a part of the system that's trying to make part of the judge's determination about the best interests. No, the child doesn't have two representatives, as the DA says. I'm the representative of the child. The guardian ad litem is part of the system, and it impresses me that in the opposition to this proposal, we can see the system trying to perpetuate itself. They take the position that when a client can't express, and I've represented pre-verbal children, a client can't express an opinion, the role of the attorney is to stand down and do nothing. That's not the role of an attorney. The role of an attorney is to protect the client and use the tools she has to do that. This is a system that works well, the system we have now. We should make sure that it's properly authorized. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Anybody else in Las Vegas speaking on behalf of this ADKT?
No, Chief.
Okay. Colleagues, do you have any questions for any of our speakers? Okay, hearing none. How about here in Carson City? Do we have anyone speaking on behalf of the ADKT?
Good afternoon. I'm Dion Contine. I'm the executive director at Washoe Legal Services. We also represent children in the child welfare system in Washoe County, Carson City, Lyon County, Story County, Humboldt County, and Pershing County. So of all in all of our representation, we represent approximately 1,500 kids a year. And we are here, I'm not going to belabor because everybody did a great job. I'm not going to belabor the point. We're here in support of the ADKT as well, as it's written. And I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, who is the supervisor of our program, Jeff Briggs, and he's going to talk a little bit about his experience. Thank you.
Thank you, Justices. Again, my name is Jeff Briggs. I've been a children's attorney for over 10 years. It's exclusively what I've done with Washoe Legal Services. Over the last 2 years, I've been the supervising attorney. I supervise 9 attorneys in Washoe County, 1 in Carson City, 1 in Lyon County, and we have a contract attorney in Humboldt and Lander County. For my 10 years, the turnover in child advocacy attorneys is great. I'm the only one left from the time I started. It's hard to find people to represent kids. It's hard to retain them. It's not as hard to train them, but I believe this rule would do all three of those things. It would make it easier to find good people. It would make it easier to train them. And with a set of rules right in front of them, it makes them it easier for them to do their job, as a previous speaker has mentioned already. In my experience, going to the point of contention, the substituted judgment issue, in my experience representing pre-verbal babies and non-verbal older children who may have some issue, just because they're pre-verbal, just because they're non-verbal, doesn't mean they don't have statutory and constitutional rights that need to be looked after, that need to be brought up in front of a court, in our adversary process, where the district attorney's office may disagree with us, where the public defender's office may disagree with us. But who better to bring up those rights, to guard those rights, and to bring them to the court than the lawyer that's representing the child? I don't believe that's the job of a CASA, and I believe the written materials that you have indicate that it's very, very difficult to find CASA. It's almost impossible to find CASA volunteers in the rural counties. And in Washoe County, it's very difficult as well. for our part, Washoe Legal Services, myself and my attorneys, we support this proposed rule. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else in Carson City? Okay, moving back to Las Vegas, is there anybody that wishes to speak in opposition of this matter or have comments contrary to those expressed concerning this matter?
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and members of the Honorable Court. I am Bridget Duffy, the Chief of the Juvenile Division for the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and thank you for the opportunity today to participate in the ADKT hearing on 0598. I have been working in the field of child dependency for my entire 22-year career in Clark County as both an agency attorney and as a hearing master in the 8th Judicial District. I also sit on many boards and commissions on behalf of the district attorney, including this court's Court Improvement Project and the Children's Commission. And I would like to first say, despite what's being said publicly about the DAs from across the state not being supportive of legal or constitutional rights of children or trying to submarine programs, that could be further from the truth. The DAs in this state were the driving force behind the creation of a statute to provide for warrants for removal from children from their homes and to protect their constitutional right to be free from illegal seizures. But that statute was a collaboration of stakeholders from across Nevada, and this proposed ADKT was not prepared with input from key stakeholders, including agency attorneys, the agency itself, other attorneys involved in the system, and our court-appointed special advocates, and I would believe also some judges from our rurals and Washoe County. I'm going to defer some of my comments to my colleague in Washoe who did a lot of research on the ABA and the NAACC rules, but we did discover that many jurisdictions who enacted these rules with the support of the ABA and the NAACC, they enacted them in their own way for their own jurisdictions to fit what they needed, not straight out of the model rules. And DA Okuma will talk a little bit more about that. And they brought together stakeholders from across the state to put together and collaborate on the needs of children for rural and urban jurisdictions. And not doing that here is a missed opportunity in the creation of these rules of conduct. In response to the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada's statements that indicate that the DAs did not base comments on social science or academia, I will say the following. I work for both children and families in the foster care system and in the delinquency system. And as the social science, I am repeatedly being educated that children's brains are not fully developed until age 25. And when you layer on the trauma that they suffer, their brains aren't making good decisions. This is why in the delinquency system, we treat children as children and not mini adults. As to the academia, deputy DAs and attorney generals, as agency's attorney, live this every day in the courtroom, working to protect children from abuse and neglect. Our role should not be diminished as important partners who are committing their careers to child protection. Every day, nonverbal children who have been severely physically abused, sexually exploited, or sexually abused are before our courts to determine what path their life will take. And we could not be more grateful for the partnership we have with the Southern Nevada Legal Center. They are amazing, and they are part of them. They challenge us, we challenge them, and that is the part of the adversarial system. But for those children who are nonverbal, who have been beaten to near death or sexually abused, it is difficult to hear attorneys advocate for them to return home when those children also don't have a best interest voice in that courtroom. We have an NRS on the books since 1985 that has been unfunded. That is the Guardian Ad Litem CASA statute. In Clark County, as you heard Judge Sullivan testify, while we are proud of those numbers, that is still only one-fourth of the children in foster care represented by a guardian ad litem or CASA. In Washoe, only 10% have that voice in court. The DA's office in Clark moved to an agency representation model at the request of many community partners, which took us out of that argument for best interest and really relying solely on that CASA voice, one-fourth of the children. So even as you heard today in the testimony, that substituted judgment, it's confusing. It may have been better vetted with partners from across the state to figure out how that is going to look. because while we have the best law firm for children in Clark County, it is different across this vast state. And so we have to make sure that all of our children are equally treated. So there's a few things as I wrap up and pass it off to Ms. Akuma up north. We do believe that this could have been solved with some coordination, with some collaboration. We believe it's inconsistent with existing law, which I don't need to cite to you because I believe you can review the SB case as well as the statements in there that they don't have substituted judgment. They are there to represent what the child wants. And all we think is that if you're going to be putting in a substituted judgment model for a child, there should 100% be a guardian ad litem side by side with that child that is talking to the attorney, the attorney is talking to the GAL, whatever model we choose, but this should have been done with more collaboration and stakeholders' input so that we could really vet out what that substituted judgment means. Besides that, 100% support rules of conduct and procedure for children's attorneys. Our only objection is to the use of the term substituted judgment and its improper vetting. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else in Las Vegas?
No, Chief.
Okay, turning to Carson City. One more left, yes. Come on up.
Thank you, Justices. I'm Buffy Okuma from the Washoe County District Attorney's Office. I'm the Chief Deputy District Attorney of our CPS unit. But I come to you today not just as an agency attorney. I, too, have spent more than 20 years in child welfare, four of those years as a child's attorney, over seven of those years as a juvenile master. And I want to boil it down to exactly what has been talked about today in the definition of substituted judgment in the Model Act. I think it's first important to note, while I did not get through all 50 states, I have only found to date one state that has adopted those model rules as written and as proffered to you with regard to the definition of substituted judgment. And I submit to you that that definition for a pre-verbal infant child is a fiction. There's no way for a person to be able to determine what an infant or pre-verbal child would want if they can't express it. That's our point. And in those situations, either, and our comments, I will just say, were developed quickly because we were not brought into the collaboration about this language. And so we offer suggestions for those things. But it's important to note what other alternatives have been out there and what other alternatives could be chosen that is more based in reality than the legal fiction of being able to determine what a nonverbal or infant would want. For example, I think it's important to note that the Model Act has been in effect for over 10 years, but that Arizona is the only state that I could find that has adopted the language as written. In other states, for example, in Oregon, they permit what they call substituted judgment, but their definition of that is that the attorney is to advocate for the child's interest of safety and permanency. That's vastly different than putting themselves in the shoes of the child, as was stated by one of the other attorneys. Washington used the ABA model as their foundation as well, but changed certain sections because they didn't fit, and one of those included substituted judgment. If the child can't direct representation in Washington, the child attorney advocates for the child's legal rights, and those need to be defined. In Iowa, similar. If the child has diminished capacity and can't represent their wishes to the attorney, then the attorney advocates for the child's legal interest or requests a guardian ad litem. The point here is that there's not a large precedent of states adopting the language in the Model Act as it's written and as that specific definition is put before you. And I think it is telling that there's not, because it's a fiction. With regard to the definition of substituted judgment in front of you. Again, if the child has never been able to express a position, how would the child attorney know what position the child would take? There's no dispute with child-directed representation. Every other thing has been that everyone has said we completely agree with. Child-directed representation is important and has been very important in our state. But when the child doesn't have that capacity, it is not on par the same as the other attorneys in the case, which is what has been advocated for of a child's attorney. No other parties in the case have the sole decision-making to decide whether or not their client has capacity. And then if they decide in their sole decision-making that they don't, to then decide in their sole decision-making what that child would want. Importantly, when the other parties to the case have taken a position, the child's attorney, as well as all of the others, get to examine them, get to examine our client to weed out and to criticize the position that we might be advocating for. When it's a child's attorney making these determinations in their sole discretion, in secret, we don't know what they've done, we don't know who they've talked to, we don't know any of those things, and we don't get to examine them unless, by stepping into the child's shoes, they become a party. They become a witness. Otherwise, we don't get to find out, on what did you base your decision? We don't get to cross-examine them. We don't get to examine them as to who they talked to. What percentage of time did they spend, like we would with any other party to the case? That's our concern. The Nevada legislature has made it clear that a child is a party and that the attorney representing the child has the same authority and rights as representing any other party. A lawyer in the role of that sole decision maker is not the same as the other parties in the case. There have been occasions where the child attorney is asserting a position on behalf of a nonverbal child, and the rest of us are puzzled on what is that advocacy based. But we don't get to know because we don't get to cross-examine them, and their client's nonverbal. In April of this year, it's important to note that Colorado adopted new rules for the appointment of attorneys for children. Colorado is the home of the NACC. In the Colorado law, it provides for appointment of attorneys in a client-directed model for children who are 12 and over. For children who are under 12 or who have diminished capacity, it calls for the appointment of a guardian ad litem, because that's what a guardian ad litem does. They stand in the shoes to determine what's in the best interest. And then the attorney who's appointed collaborates with that guardian ad litem, and that's how the representation is directed. We're not suggesting that the guardian ad litem, that the child doesn't have an attorney and they just have a guardian ad litem. We're suggesting that traditional role. That's what the role of a guardian ad litem is for, to then collaborate with, get that advice from, direction from, and advocacy of the child's attorney, with that guardian ad litem standing in the shoes. But it's not appropriate for any attorney to stand in the shoes of their client in our system of advocacy. We do support all of the rules, with exception of that definition of substituted judgment, and believe that it could be clarified, that a different term could be used, and that a system that more protects those nonverbal and pre-verbal children is important. I only wanted to touch on one other aspect of the rules as proposed, and it goes to show what happens when we have a lack of collaboration. The rules with regard to training and experience suggest two models. Either you have an attorney who works full-time as a child advocacy attorney, and they have one set of proposed rules for their education and continuing education, or pro bono attorneys, and they have a separate set of rules for their education and continuing education requirements. In a large part of this state, there are attorneys that don't fit into either of those. There are attorneys throughout the state who represent children, but also do other things, but they're paid attorneys. They, in many of our rules, that's the case. And we also have many situations, for example, in Carson City, where if their agency or their Washoe Legal Services attorney has a conflict, then the court appoints another attorney who does not solely do child welfare law, but is also being paid and is not pro bono. So there's a very variety of situations that go on across our state, which is why collaboration when we are looking at statewide rules is so important. But with that, we appreciate our child advocacy partners. I think you could see earlier, we have a very great relationship. We value them. We think that the vast majority of these rules are absolutely on point, but we think that sole aspect needs some more work.
Okay, thank you very much. There's no one else here in Carson City, and Justice Pickering, you indicated there's no one else in Las Vegas who wishes to speak. So, Justice Hardesty, I'm going to turn this back to you. And I guess my question is, it doesn't sound like there was any collaboration before this was proposed. I would like to hear a little more about that if anyone could shed some light, and perhaps you know, Justice Hardesty.
Excuse me. Thanks, Chief. I don't know about the communication with the DA's office, but I know that there is an underlying disagreement about the issue here. Regardless of terminology, there's a very difference in approach. I am happy to reach out to the parties who spoke today to find out if there is any potential resolution, either in terminology or substance, and report back to the court in 30 days as to what I learned. I think fundamentally there are different points of view about the attorney's role in representing the child, and what circumstances arise. I guess from a personal point of view, I'm a little bit concerned that the DA's office would want to examine or cross-examine the attorney for the child. In any other world, we would find that to be abhorrent and problematic. But I'm happy to reach out to both speakers on behalf of the DA's office as well as both legal aid organizations and see if there's some corrective measures that could be presented to the court in an amendment to the petition or not. And I'll report back in 30 days.
And I think personally, that would be helpful to me to inform my decision. So I favor that. Colleagues, other colleagues, any comments, any observations, any additional questions? Okay, hearing none, then I'm going to conclude this public hearing. The matter will stand submitted. The court will stand in recess until the